Well, thank you for your attention on this last day. I'm going to speak to the health status of HIV-infected women who are entering or re-entering care as part of the Women of Color initiative that Jessica has described. My collaborators on this work include colleagues from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Arthur Blank, Jason Fletcher, and Nico Verdakis, as well as Betsy Eastwood from City University of New York. The acknowledgments that I have to make is the funding that we received through the SPINS program. We have no interest, conflicts of interest or sponsorships to report, and all of the work was approved by the institutional review boards of the participating institutions. So why is an access to HIV care project needed for women of color? Well, we've heard from the prior speakers as well as from the literature that women use antiretroviral therapy less frequently. They have more missed medical appointments. They have late access to ART and frequent discontinuation of medications. And all of this leads to a higher mortality that's been reported for non-white women. So this describes the initiative, the attend intervention sites and evaluation center. 925 women were recruited and completed a baseline interview. The eligibility criteria is that subjects had to self-identify as female, self-identify as non-white, be HIV infected, and they could not have received care in HIV-specific care in the last 6 months prior to the enrollment at the site of enrollment. So therefore, women who had received HIV-specific care at other sites were allowed to be enrolled. The evaluation included a standardized survey instrument that included questions on demographics, health status, illness, HIV care delivery systems, medication adherence, barriers to care, risk behaviors, as well as mental health. Chi-square tests or exact statistics were used for tests of significance. So the first question that we wanted to address is what the impact of HIV-related and non-related illnesses were on the health status of the women who were entering or re-entering care. And we asked questions about illnesses, specifically HIV-related illnesses such as AIDS, dementia, wasting. We asked questions about HIV non-related illnesses, such as cardiac disease, diabetes, high blood pressure. We asked women about their experience with functional limitations at the time they were doing the baseline enrollment. So when women were described themselves as having some level of functional limitation that impaired their ability, their activity during the day, we asked them to identify what was the cause of that functional limitation. And so we specifically offered diagnoses of musculoskeletal diseases with arthritis, cervical and back problems, bone injuries, including fracture. We asked questions about metabolic syndrome diagnoses, such as cardiovascular disease, stroke, high blood pressure, diabetes. And we asked questions about diseases that had co-occurring risk or exposures, such as sexually transmitted infections and hepatitis C. And then finally, we asked specifically about questions related to women's health, sexually transmitted infections, abnormal pap tests, and pregnancy. Here are the sites that were participating. Because there was a wide distribution of sites, with six sites being located in urban centers across the country, such as LA and Brooklyn, New Jersey, New York, Chicago, Miami, as compared to sites that were in the rural areas, spanning from Northeast Texas through Alabama, Georgia, and North Carolina. We wanted to see if women recruited in the rural and more southern sites differed from the more urban and which were mostly outside of the southern U.S. And how do their health differ? Now, one caveat is that when I describe a rural woman versus an urban woman, I'm not actually talking about where that woman might live. I'm talking about the site at which she was recruited. So it's quite possible that a woman could live in a city and commute to a rural site or vice versa. But this is the information that we had. So I'm going to go through the demographic characteristics that stood out in terms of thinking about their health status. We've seen a little bit about that before from Nico. The results of the demographics here are stratified by the urban versus the rural sites, and the numbers represent the percentage of the column totals. Age was stratified into three categories, and one out of five of the women entering HIV care in this study was over 50, and that didn't differ by rural urban sites. Ethnic characteristics did differ by rural and urban sites. There were more non-Hispanic blacks in the rural sites, as there were more Hispanic Latina recruits in the urban population. Rural women had a higher level of education. Rural women, two-thirds of them, had a high school or more level of education, whereas the urban women, it was about 50-50 as to whether they had a high school more or less of an education. Rural women reported more partnerships. Although most of the women reported no current partnership and no prior marriage, with approximately 60% of all of the women in the group in that category, rural women, or 21% of rural women reported being in a marriage or a partnership relationship, and this is only 14% for the urban women. When it came to employment, rural women actually reported more employment and more medical disability. Any here indicates any level of work, so part-time or full-time employment was combined, with 28% of the rural women compared to 14% of the urban women reporting any level of work. Medical disability was reported by a third of the rural women and only about a fifth for the urban women. And then in the screening interview, the HIV care status was established, and women could be categorized as being a newly diagnosed, which meant they had received a diagnosis in less than 3 months ago. They were new to care, which meant they had received a diagnosis longer than 3 months ago, but they had not received any HIV-specific care. That they were transferring for care, which means they may have received some care in the last 6 months. Sporadic care referred to those women who had received care at this recruitment site, but no HIV-specific care in the last 6 months. And lost to care meant that they had not received HIV-specific care in the last year. And it differed somewhat from urban to rural sites, with more transfers of care in urban settings and more sporadic care in rural settings. When we get to medical history, in addition to the questions related to the illnesses that I've described, we also had questions from the CDC health-related quality of life. We asked about number of physical, mental unhealthy days, as well as days in which activity was limited, and that symptoms related to days with predominated with depression symptoms, anxiety, pain, or insomnia. So when we looked at all of those illnesses, most of them were very similar between rural and urban sites, and I don't go through all of the data here, but there was a couple of things that showed some different distribution. Women in urban sites were more likely to report having received an AIDS diagnosis or having hepatitis C infection. And rural women were more likely to report hypertension and cardiovascular disease. And I think this is interesting because if you look at this, hepatitis C and AIDS are HIV-related conditions, and hypertension and cardiovascular are not really HIV-related conditions. So it does show some differences there. The women's health issues were reported very commonly. About 50% of all the women reported a past history of a sexually transmitted infection other than HIV, of course. It was the difference between rural and urban was particularly pronounced for women reporting a history of candida vaginitis, with 60% of the rural women reporting that and 40% of the urban women. 20% of those women who were biologically able to be pregnant, so not having a surgical procedure and not being postmenopausal, were pregnant at the time of enrollment. And that was greater for the rural women. In terms of who we asked about the functional impairment, a third of the women reported that they had a functional impairment at the time of the baseline interview, and this did not differ by rural or urban status. Physically unhealthy days, when we looked at the stratification by functional limitation, those women who didn't report a current functional limitation still reported on average 4 to 5 days in the last 30 days where they had were physically unhealthy. And this goes up to 11 to 12 days in the last 30 days for those women who reported a functional limitation. There was really no difference seen between the urban and the rural populations. For mentally unhealthy days, a similar distribution was seen. Again, no difference between urban and rural. For women who reported no functional limitation, they reported 9 days on average in the last 30 of having mentally unhealthy days, which is a pretty big burden of disease when you think about it. And this goes up even further for those women who are reporting functional limitations to between 13 and 15 days. When we asked women what they attributed their functional limitation to, you can see, so this is just looking at those women who reported a functional limitation and asking them specifically what caused their functional limitation. And you can see there's a wide variety of things that were the attributing factors in the minds of the women. In blue, over on the left-hand side of the slide, you can see the musculoskeletal symptoms, which were reported by between 2 and 4% of the women with arthritis, spine difficulties, bone injury, and walking difficulties. 3% of the women attributed their functional limitation to pulmonary problems. And then the 4 metabolic disorder diagnoses, heart disease, stroke, hypertension, diabetes, were reported by approximately 1% each. There were very few people who attributed their functional limitation to cancer. There was some sensory deprivation that was the etiology of their functional limitation, and 4% of women attributed their functional limitation to mood disorders. To further understand the functional limitations, we developed regression models in a hierarchical fashion. Our first model, we included all the predictors that were shown as significant in our bivariate analysis, had strong associations in the literature, or were felt to be important for reasons of confounding. The rural discrimination was not included in the first model. In the second model, we dropped non-significant predictors at a level of 0.1, and then we added in the rural-urban variable. And in the third and final model, we dropped non-significant predictors from the second model at the level of 0.05, and we retained the rural-urban variable. And what we saw was that functional limitation was associated with physical health. It was associated with employment, which is somewhat consistent with what you might anticipate, but it was not associated with rural and urban status. When we looked, age persisted through these models as an important variable, which is not too surprising. Those of us who are getting older know that. but what I think surprising was that the impact began at age 30. So the category between age 30 and 50 had a 2.5 fold increased risk of functional limitation. And this went up for women who were over 50, but it didn't go up that much. It went up to not quite threefold. Having HIV for longer than a year at the time of the baseline interview presented a twofold risk compared to those women who'd been diagnosed for less than 3 months. And of all the other illnesses, cardiac problems was the most predictive of functional limitation. Self-report of heart problems had a sevenfold risk of functional limitation, so a pretty big impact. So in conclusion, the clinical variables associated with functional impairment were having HIV for longer than a year and having cardiovascular disease. Age was also an important associated variable with risk beginning at age 30. Functional impairment is common and is likely to increase as this population increases in age. And impairment is related to physical health, but less so mental health. Despite the high prevalence of mentally unhealthy days, it did not turn out to be predictive in the final models. And geography of site was not associated with impairment. And I'd like to acknowledge all the clinical and project staff who contributed to this work and made it possible. And I'm happy to open the presentation for questions. Yes, ma'am.
I'm really struck by the age of impairment starting at 30. It's so young. I had a question, but you said something about Hep C being associated with HIV, and I'm wondering if you could talk more about that.
Well, hepatitis C and HIV, well, hepatitis C is not a, you know, AIDS-related condition. It shares exposure history, so commonalities of sexual transmission or transmission through shared, through injection drug use. And so it has a shared risk, but it's not directly an HIV-related condition.
Right. So I mean, from my understanding, most of the time women contract HIV through sexual contact, but have C through injection drug use contact. So, with your sample,
I can't tell you. I think that from general knowledge, it would be what we would anticipate from the data, but I have not looked specifically to see if the people who report, you know, had hepatitis C were also those who had injection drug use. And we did recruit from urban centers where injection drug use was at least more common, if not, the most common, common reason. We don't have a lot of injection drug use in North Carolina, for instance, but some of the more urban centers had more. Yes, ma'am.
So I thought it was actually pretty interesting that heart problems were such a serious, impact for functionality. And given that a lot of heart disease is preventable, I'm wondering what you think, like, what the implications of that are and how future interventions can kind of bridge the chronic and the HIV.
Right. So, you know, we have information about smoking history. I didn't put that in any of these models. That's one of the first things to look at. And we didn't, you know, we don't have obesity. So those are two, you know, very important medical contributors to cardiovascular disease. I know from my experience in North Carolina, being a tobacco state, we have a big problem with tobacco, and we have a big problem with obesity. And so I think those are really, really important public health targets for our population.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and, you know, I think if we'd have done a study 15, even maybe 10 years ago, we would not have seen cardiovascular disease sort of jumping out at us. But as we can reduce the impact of the classic HIV-related illnesses, then I think there's a contribution of HIV towards cardiovascular disease. A treatment for HIV has gone through an evolution. We are at, now there's some evidence that putting people on treatment even very early, despite whatever CD4 count they have, may have long-term cardiovascular protective benefits. So there are a number of different things that we can think about. That's it.